A New Life in America, Today on the World. I'm Carol Hills. A Somali refugee comes to America to start a new life and winds up discovering a new reality.
Racism is a new lesson to me. It's a new experience to me. In my entire life, I never had somebody hate my color.
Plus, a former neo-Nazi in Norway who now works to keep kids out of radical groups.
So we have to be better than them, you know, better than the neo-Nazis, better than the jihadists, who are actually pretty good at identifying these people. As social workers, need to be there before they.
And an English teacher in Spain named Juan Carrion, who became a local celebrity after meeting one of the Beatles.
John Lennon made three promises to Juan Carrion as a result of that meeting.
Find out what John promised Juan ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. Good to have you with us this Friday. President Trump won't say exactly when he'll make a decision on DACA, but White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders says that decision will be announced next Tuesday. DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's the program started under the Obama administration that protects undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. Some state officials have threatened to sue if Trump doesn't end DACA. We'll follow up on that story next week. DACA's only one of the big immigration stories these days. There's Trump's travel ban as well. One of the countries where residents are currently barred from entering the U.S. is Somalia. But luckily for one young Somali named Abdi Noor, he's already here. The World's Leo Hornack has been following his story for 3 years now. Leo told the first part of that story on an episode of This American Life. Now Leo's caught up with the young Somali again, this time in Maine, for a new BBC radio documentary about him. Leo, remind us who Abdi is and how he got to Maine.
So Abdi is a very, very lucky guy, but he's also a very, very resilient guy. He was born in Mogadishu, lived through, had a childhood in the civil war in Somalia, then managed to get out of Somalia when he was a young man, arrived in Kenya, and then he got very, very lucky. He won a ticket for the U.S. Green Card Lottery. And he reached Maine. And I've had the honor and strange kind of privilege of following his life for the last 3.5 years. And so the situation right now is that Abdi has been living in Maine, trying to make a life there for himself as what he calls a real American.
What were his initial impressions of the U.S.?
Well, this is what's great about this project, Harry, is I've been able to sort of watch his initial impressions change and have recorded them. And it's been... It was a revelation for him when he arrived, some of the things in the US, and also for me, because I'm not an American either. And we actually shared many of the same surprises about the everyday elements in American life. I mean, for example, some things he was amazed by were just the sheer variety of ice cream flavors. And as a Brit, we don't bother with quite so many ice cream flavors either. And some things were, you know, less of a surprise maybe for me, but for him were utterly, utterly bizarre. I mean, I still remember in one of the first conversations we had after he arrived in Maine, he was telling me about this machine that heats bread in the kitchen. He couldn't remember the name of it. And I was able to supply him with the word toaster. And it was a new part of his vocabulary. But, Carol, I will tell you about maybe the most bizarre thing that Abdi experienced. And this happened one night when he was finishing a driving lesson. He walked out. He was just enjoying looking at the stars. Remember, this is rural Maine. It's far from any cities. And this car pulled up next to him with these blue lights flashing. And this is what he told me.
This white guy got off the car and he's like, "Sir, what are you doing here?" That's what he said. "What are you doing here?" Yes, trust me, I was freaked out. I mean, I got really scared. He said, "Okay, have a wonderful night, sir. Bye-bye." And I was just looking at him. There's no disturbance. There's no, like, give me money. There's nothing like that. Just left me. There's no racism at all.
It's interesting. Abdi says there's no racism. Of course, there's all sorts of examples since he's been in the States of police brutality. What has he thought about that?
Well, that recording, that clip you just heard there, was actually at the time of all the disturbances in Ferguson. And I think that was very much on Abdi's mind. And that's why one of the reasons he was so surprised. But the other aspect is this is someone who's coming from Kenya as a Somali. And Somalis in Kenya are used to every encounter with the authorities, with the police, to be the start of bribery, a shakedown, or worse. I mean, Kenyan police officers call Somalis ATMs. That joke refers to the idea that an ATM is something you can go up to at any time of day or night and get money from. So that gives you the reason that surprise you hear in Abdi's voice is there. But I think the change that I've really seen since then, and Abdi would agree with this, is he's begun to have a much more nuanced view of how race works in America and how the police and the authorities see people like him in a state like Maine.
Why has that happened? What's he encountered?
You know, one of the big things, of course, is just the rise of Trump and the change in rhetoric towards people like him. The idea that someone could be banned from the U.S. as a refugee because they come from a country like Somalia, because Somalia has a terrorism problem. And just the very fact of being born in that country means that you are banned automatically, regardless of the details of your life or your own case. That deeply changed Abdi's attitude to America. And, of course, with the events in Charlottesville, this has become even more uppermost in everyone's mind. And I spoke to Abdi just last week about his reaction to Charlottesville and how it made him feel as a Muslim black refugee living in the United States. Here's what he told me.
Unbelievable. You know, Leo, I've watched what these guys were doing, and I've watched what they said, that they were against Jews, against the black people, you know, and racism is a new lesson to me. It's a new experience to me. In my entire life, I never had somebody hate my color. In Kenya, it's about the ethnicity. It's about who you are and where you come from. And what, like Somali, the name of Somali and the way we look was hated. And now it seems like here in the United States, it's just, and this is the only country in the entire world that I really thought that would cover me from all of the hate things that exist in this world.
Hmm. It's so interesting hearing something like that from him. There's such a different perspective from other Americans. It's such an interesting time to hear
absolutely
his comment.
And a difference in perspective from that clip you heard earlier 3 years ago with his first encounter with a U.S. police officer.
What's Abdi's life like now? Where does he live in Maine and how does he make a living?
The great news that Abdi's had is that he's just been accepted on a scholarship to a university in Maine. And there's been another breakthrough on a personal level, which is he's got a book deal after his story was featured in This American Life. He's written his own autobiography, and that's going to be coming out later this year. But it doesn't really change the underlying problem for Abdi, as he's expressed it to me, which is that life in America isn't really quite the dreamland, as he used to call it, that he dreamed of when he was a kid.
But he's not thinking of going back, is he?
Absolutely not. I think you're right that there is a context there, which is however tough things might be in the United States, it's not quite at the level of Mogadishu right now.
How has he been making a living in Maine until now?
Well, initially when he got to the States, he worked with a kind of blue-collar construction firm. And that was one of the big culture shocks, really, because he was the only non-white, non-Mainer, as they told him, in the crew. And he had to really adapt to the difference in culture there. And yeah, that was quite a learning curve for him. Since then, he's now works as a translator for charities helping Somali refugees in Maine and doing things to make a bit of extra cash, doing things like Uber driving. So he's really keen to get to university, to get on to the next level, to kind of achieve a much more white collar, if you like, American dream for himself.
What does he want to do?
At the moment, I think Abdi isn't completely clear what he'll do after he leaves university, but I think he's pretty keen to make sure that people across the state have a better understanding of how refugees see the world.
The World's Leo Hornack giving us an update on Abdi Noor, a Somali refugee he's been following for the past 3 years who now lives in Maine. Thanks, Leo.
Thanks very much, Carol.
This week, we've been following the deadly, destructive flooding caused by Tropical Storm Harvey. But Texans are hardly alone. West Africans have seen some truly staggering rainfall in the past few days. And in South Asia, torrential storms have forced millions out of their homes. Across India, Nepal, and Bangladesh, there's entire villages that are underwater, and upwards of 1,000 people have died. My BBC colleague Justin Rowlett is in Bihar State in northeast India. He says it's been hit especially hard by the floods.
In this part of Bihar, the roads are kind of raised up above the level of the fields, so they act as barriers with the floods building up into great reservoirs of water. Now, as that's forced its way through down to the river, it's ripped off the sides of roads in places. It's brought down bridges, as well as tearing down literally hundreds of thousands of homes. Now, one of the most striking things as we drove along were the little huddles of makeshift buildings that appear alongside the road every now and then. We're talking the most rudimentary of shelters, a couple of wooden poles, maybe a tarpaulin or a scrap of corrugated iron over them. And these are where tens of thousands of people whose homes have been destroyed are now living. Budhia Devi is one of them. She told us how this year's floods have upended her life.
I've lost everything. I had a cow and a goat. They were both killed. My house is totally broken, and I'm just left sitting here by the side of the road. I've got nothing left. I just don't know what to do.
She's lost all her savings. She's lost her livelihood. What she's really saying is that now she is destitute.
Why has this monsoon season been so bad in this region?
Well, I mean, first off, it's a very heavy monsoon. There's been more rain than usual. But the other issue is simply the lack of resilience in these communities. So, I mean, to take a really, really basic example, virtually nobody in India knows how to swim. You haven't got any swimming pools or virtually no swimming pools here. Most of the rivers and lakes aren't fit to bathe in. And if you think what that means, the fact that people can't swim, what that means when floods come, you can understand why the death toll is so high. Trip up, fall into the water, and basically it's all over.
What kind of relief efforts are going on in the region of Bihar?
Now, there is a huge relief effort. I mean, lots of resources have been coming in, but it's not nearly as coordinated. It's not nearly as well resourced as it is elsewhere. So you've got kind of charities like the Red Cross, charities like Save the Children operating here. You've got the indigenous, the local relief organizations, the police, the army, the fire service, people like that, helping, bringing boats in, trying to rescue people, trying to bring supplies to communities that have been isolated, put shelters up to shelter people who've lost their homes, that sort of thing. The problem is that it's just much harder. The resources are much more stretched. There's less money around. And the people, as I say, are less resilient, less able to kind of bear the strain. They haven't got savings. They haven't got money. They haven't got anything that can help them survive once their kind of livelihoods, everything they've got is washed away. And that's what these floods have done for literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. Remember, the total number of people, according to the UN, affected by these floods is now in South Asia is 41 million. So just an absolutely devastating picture across the entire region.
You've been reporting in South Asia for some time now. Do you get the sense that people there are feeling like this is happening more often in terms of the severity of the monsoon season and the severity of flooding?
I mean, the monsoon season varies. I mean, I've been here for 2.5 years. For the first 2 years, the big issue was the lack of monsoon and the fact that it got incredibly hot and dry in the summer. There was huge water shortages. So there's kind of two extremes. We've seen these terrible, terrible dry seasons. And then now we've seen these terrible floods. So what we're seeing is a pattern of extreme weather events. And that's actually what the climate change scientists would suggest is likely to happen as we see global warming progress. They'd never say we're able to pin a single event. They wouldn't say this monsoon is a result of climate change. But what they do say is that extreme weather events of this kind are more likely as the world gets warmer. So, for example, there's as every half degree that the temperature rises, the air has a capacity to hold 3% more water. So, you know, and also obviously temperature differentials are what drive storms. So you can see that as the temperature gets hotter, you're likely to have bigger, more violent storms. And we're seeing big storms. I mean, it may be coincidence, it may be climate change, but we're seeing big storms here in Asia. There have been big storms in Africa. And of course, as you know very well, there have been huge storms in America this year.
The BBC's Justin Rowlett in Bihar in northeast India, covering the terrible floods there. Thanks so much, Justin.
Listen, that was my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, saying no to neo-Nazis in Norway. You're with The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The World in Words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The World in Words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. These days, Tom Olson helps keep kids out of white supremacist movements. But his aim in life was a lot different just a few years ago. As a teenager growing up in Norway, Olson made a fateful decision. He joined a neo-Nazi group.
I was in this movement for a long time. I spent 7 or 8 years there. And for at least 5 of those years, I truly believed in the cause. And I did a lot of horrible things in the name of the cause.
That was in the early 1990s. Many new immigrants were arriving in Norway, and the neo-Nazis didn't like it. They wanted immigrants out of the country. But that's not why Tom Olson joined the neo-Nazi movement originally.
I had a dear friend who became a drug addict, and I could only see how quickly his life fell apart and his mental state became drastically reduced. You know, he was a mess quite soon. I got very strong opinions regarding drugs, you know, that I hate the drugs and I hate the drug dealers and all these things. And you have a movement in America called Antifa.
Yes, Antifa.
And Antifa here in Norway, they are also part of a movement called Blitz, which is anarchists that occupy houses. And often these anarchists, they have a liberal mindset when it comes to drugs and drugs use, especially marijuana. And these people came to my hometown and occupied a house, and they started spreading the word about the free marijuana and things like that. And of course, they were also pro-immigrant.
So these are kind of radical leftist kind of Antifa people. And so you...
Yeah, that I got in conflict with.
And you got in conflict with them because of their attitudes towards drugs. You link your sadness over your own friend. And then how did it move from that to anti-immigrant?
There was neo-Nazis in the area. In the weekends, they would come into town and they would fight with these anarchists. And I was involved in fights with them too because of their pro-drug or their liberal attitudes towards drugs. And we didn't want them to occupy the house, which was just over the street of the mall that we would socialize at. And of course, when the neo-Nazis were fighting them, we soon figured out that if we united, we could actually take them out. And I'm not like meaning like killing them, but kick them out of the house, which we eventually managed to do. We got them out of town.
And then did you end up taking on the attitudes of a neo-Nazi?
It actually started with a party, and they had a huge swastika flag in there, and I didn't like it much. But it was a party, you know, and we had experiences that in a way united us. So politics wasn't much of a talk at that first party, but we continued meeting them, and it became less alcohol and more ideology. And they would, you know, tell tales about how the Jews were not exterminated by the Germans, that the pictures you saw from World War II was actually not Jews. It was civilian Germans that had been killed by the Russians.
So you're getting these different influences. You eventually end up in jail. How did you end up in jail?
Actually, what we did, the crime we did, we went around town with spray cans and we tagged all the buildings with slogans and swastikas, and we even painted a police car with swastikas.
Did you ever harass or persecute anybody, a non-white person in Norway? Did you ever go after people?
Oh, yeah. After my first stay in jail, you know, I became even more radicalized because even though I was isolated, I would get all this literature. So I would get Revolution by Number 14 by David Lane, Might is Right, Survival of the Fittest, Mein Kampf. All these books came into my cell and I was isolated. So I would just sit there and read in my own little bubble.
What was the worst thing you ever did as a neo-Nazi?
It was a lot of things that I deeply regret today, but nothing provoked me more than seeing a black man with a white woman. So, you know, we could just be out walking, and if we saw somebody, a couple like that, you know, we would attack them and beat them a lot and very hard and very bloody. And then we would just walk like nothing happened, you know.
And then did you serve time in jail for those crimes?
Yeah, a few times. We got caught, you know, maybe one out of five times or something like that.
So at this time, you're sort of full of this belief that somehow it's people of color who are to blame for things and bringing your nation down. You start to think differently when you visit South Africa. What happened there?
I had been in jail in Norway, and I was very frustrated about everything because it was a lot of backstabbing going on in the movement. Too many little kings that wanted to be the chief king, you know. So it wasn't a united movement. And luckily, they haven't managed to unite even today. So it's a lot of backstabbing even today. So I went to South Africa. I had friends down there, and they told me that there would be a civil war and that they needed volunteers to come down and fight for the white race in South Africa. So I jumped on the plane with a one-way ticket.
What specifically changed your outlook?
In Johannesburg, I went to a backpack place. Two things happened there. Thing number one, we were robbed by a bunch, I would say it was maybe five or six black South Africans. And I was covered with swastikas, you know, because I had like a fetish for these things. I would show them off everywhere. And he didn't shoot me. He pointed a gun at my head, wanted my money. And I thought he would kill me. I looked him in the eyes, and even today I remember exactly what I said. I told him, you know, I hope you don't shoot me because I would love to see the rest of your beautiful country. And he was just looking at me for a few seconds, and then he put his gun in his pants and he walked away. So I was stuck in Joburg without any money, and I stayed at the backpack place, and I promised to pay back when I got money. After a couple of days, you know, I was very hungry, and I was sitting in a bar watching rugby, and then this guy came up to me. He bought two beers, two lagers, and I got one of those lagers. I turned around to thank him, and then I saw it was, you know, it was the most friendly, disarmed, you know, his face was full of happiness, and he was just extremely friendly and disarming. So I looked at him, and I thought to myself, you must be mad, you know, can't you see who I am? So I turned against him, and I showed him my swastika t-shirt, and he just said, cheers. But then the bartender said I had to relax and enjoy my beer, so I did, and he bought me a couple of more, and we ended up drinking 4 or 5 days every evening. And the second day I had gotten to know him, he asked me, are you hungry, when he came by one afternoon. And, you know, I was very hungry because I didn't have money for food, so we ended up making Zambian food because he was from Zambia. So I was standing there, you know, with my shaved head and swastika t-shirt making Zambian food with this stranger from Zambia.
You're working now to prevent people from becoming ultra-right neo-Nazi. What is the way to prevent this, looking back at your own experience?
It's no easy answer, but I would say this. We figure out that they don't feel included in their local environment. They are looking for somewhere to be, you know, and somewhere to feel appreciated and included. So we have to be better than them, you know, better than the neo-Nazis, better than the jihadists, who are actually pretty good at identifying these people. But I know how they do it. I did it myself, you know. We would drive to institutions for the Children Protective Services and talk to the kids and recruit them. And we would go to the youth clubs, and we wouldn't talk to the youth inside, but the ones who were standing behind the bush smoking or drinking, you know, we would pick them up and, you know, tell them that you can have a purpose in your life. As social workers, need to be there before they.
Tom Olsen is a former Norwegian neo-Nazi. He now works to try to help de-radicalize white supremacists. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. Kenya's Supreme Court throws out the results of last month's presidential election, citing irregularities. For many Kenyans, that itself is a victory.
Even if they are not happy with the ruling, they say it's a win for democracy. You see, something like this has never happened in Africa, has never happened in Kenya.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The Supreme Court has declared the presidential election null and void. Nope, not here. I'm talking about Kenya. The country's top court says a new presidential election must be held within 60 days. The incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta, was the nominal winner of the election, but he said today that he will respect the Supreme Court's ruling. He also appealed for calm amid fears of unrest. Meanwhile, supporters of Kenyatta's opponent, Raila Odinga, took to the streets of Nairobi to celebrate the ruling. Reporter Wairimu Gitahi is in Nairobi. Wairimu, why did the Supreme Court nix the election? What was wrong with it?
It did not give all the details, but in general, some of the things that were discussed during the proceedings of this case were, for example, the opposition claimed that the system, the electronic system of voting, was tampered with. They also said that some of the voter forms were also tampered with. Some of them were fake. So it's such irregularities that made the court declare this presidential election null and void.
President Kenyatta has said he will respect the Supreme Court's ruling, but he's not happy, is he?
No. He's not happy. Just after it was announced, he had a press conference and he looked quite disappointed. But the interesting thing about that is that a couple of hours later, he was back in the streets. And he had already started campaigning again and saying that he's ready for another election.
How about the opposition? Raila Odinga and his party must be pretty excited.
Yes, they are excited. In fact, Raila came out and said that this is a win, not only for Kenya, but for Africa. It's a first in Africa, so it's historic. But he also said that he wants the IEBC, the ones who are taking care of the elections, for their chairman and for their CEO to resign.
So he wants the whole election commission that oversaw the election to resign.
The two top people.
What kind of reactions are you seeing from the Kenyan public?
Wow. I mean, the NASA side, Raila was presidential candidate for the NASA Alliance. I mean, they are dancing. You know, they are known very much to be quite, you know, energetic and dancing and singing. And that's exactly what they are doing in the streets, huh? I mean, so they're dancing and praising Raila. You know, you could almost think that he's already been elected as the president. But in the Jubilee strongholds, the supporters of Uhuru, they are quite silent, quite sober. It's quite quiet.
Now, from a distance, it feels like this isn't a good thing, you know, for Kenya. But is it or isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are various opinions about this. Number one, many people, even if they are not happy with the ruling, they say it's a win for democracy. You see, something like this has never happened in Africa, has never happened in Kenya. I mean, ideally, at the end of all this, the elections and all the mistakes that were made before will be corrected. You see, so it will be, people are expected to be quite a valid election. So in terms of the democracy, quite a number of people are seeing it as a win, yeah? But also some people are seeing it as a loss on their side, you see? So I think it depends on which side you are on, you know, in terms of who you're supporting or how you view democracy.
Raila Odinga and Uhuru Kenyatta are our old enemies. Just what kind of relationship do they have?
Okay, I mean, at least in the public eye, because you never know what they do in private, you know, politicians. So, but you see, their fathers were rivals already, yeah? Because for Kenyatta, his father was the first president of Kenya. And for Raila, the father was the first vice president of Kenya. So obviously this trickles down to their sons. They also come from what you would call the communities that have the most population in the country, or the ones that have a lot of say in politics in Kenya. So also this kind of like brings the issue of tribalism between the two communities that they come from. So sometimes that brings a lot of friction between the two of them. At the end of the day, the election is really between the two of them, not the other people who are vying for presidency.
Reporter Wairimu Gitahi in Nairobi, Kenya. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Political upheaval, climate, fake news, extreme weather. Boy, seems like we're buffeted almost daily by big global changes. It's hard to make sense of it all, but luckily my colleague Mary Kay Magstead thinks about this stuff all the time. Her podcast, Whose Century Is It?, examines the forces and issues shaping the 21st century. And in this week's episode, she looks at a subject she knows well, the incredible change China has been through in the past 20 years or so, and how a new generation of young Chinese see the world around them.
the young generation that I focused on in a series I did a decade ago for The World looked at the one-child generation, so those born from the early 80s onward. And if you look at how China has changed in those years, so we're talking 37 years altogether, China has gone from having a per capita GDP in 1980 of about $300 to $8,000 now. It went from being about 20% urban in 1980 to almost 60% urban now. It went from being mostly kind of isolated from the outside world, just starting to open up, to having a generation that's grown up with the internet, with foreign films and television being a part of life, with international travel increasingly being a part of life. Whereas back in 1980, even into the 90s, it was difficult for many Chinese to even get a passport. So you've got this young generation that has grown up with a different kind of connection with the world and with ideas from outside China. And those have been integrated into their own way of thinking about life and possibilities and the world and China's place in it since they were little kids. That has not been true for previous generations of Chinese.
So what has this meant specifically for young people in China and how they really think about the world? I mean, I remember that the report you spoke of from a decade ago and that you continue to follow it closely.
Well, it's different for different young people, obviously. And I think that's one of the other changes in China, that rather than people being sort of expected to move in lockstep behind the Communist Party, younger Chinese have been able to figure out, what is my life about? What is my future going to be? And while there's still a lot of nationalism among the younger generation in China, much of it inculcated through a very deliberate patriotic education campaign that the government started after the Tiananmen crackdown in 1989, some of it comes naturally and organically through the kind of experience that younger Chinese have had as they've grown up. In my most recent podcast episode, I interviewed someone else who's done a lot of thinking about how all of these changes have affected the younger generation in China and how that younger generation may well affect China's transformation going forward in this century. That person is Alec Ash, and he wrote a book called Wish Lanterns, Young Lives in New China, where he followed the lives of six different young Chinese who are roughly of his generation. He's 31 now. Started out studying Chinese in China when he was just fresh out of college. So he's had several years of getting to know this generation, focuses on these specific people in his book, and came to a few conclusions of his own about what he's seen in this young generation.
I'm consistently struck and impressed by the drive and the ambition of young Chinese, certainly those around me in Beijing and also those from elsewhere in the countryside. And a sense of agency over your own life. Because from a very young age, there's very little else to rely on except your own the belief that if you achieve academically or in the business world, you can realize your own Chinese dream. Which, of course, when Xi Jinping used that phrase shortly after he came into power in 2012 and the beginning of 2013, he first used this phrase within the context of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. His conception of the Chinese dream is everyone getting together behind the party as China becomes the great strong power in the world and economically. But what I've seen much more at the ground level and other observers have noticed as well is that the population of China seems to have run with the notion of the Chinese dream more along lines of the American dream, which is individual dreams, individual ambitions. How can I transform my own life?
That's an amazing comparison he makes in terms of the China we and the American dream I. That's a huge challenge for China, the Chinese government, I imagine.
Well, you could see it in one of two ways. You could see it as a challenge or as an opportunity. I mean, there's immense energy in this younger generation and talent and potential. And when people are thinking about, you know, kind of how can I make the most of my own life and my own future, I think Alec would agree with me that there are many young Chinese. In fact, he says this at other points in our conversation. There are young Chinese who do think about, you know, where can I volunteer? You know, maybe I'm going to go out and help teach in rural schools, or I'm going to do something for the environment. But at this particular moment in China, people who might have those impulses who would like to see social change are feeling somewhat constricted because they know that there are some things that they can do and other things that they can't do. And there are a lot more things that they can't do now than even 5 years ago.
Mary Kay, I really love your podcast. And I wonder what's next for you and whose century is it? What's on the docket for the next episode?
Whose Century Is It continues. It's going to move on to becoming a monthly podcast. And the next episode is actually a trip down the Amazon with my old friend and former colleague in China, John Watts, who's now the Guardian's environment editor. He was the correspondent in Brazil and just recently left. While he was there, we went up the Amazon and did some reporting on the environment in Brazil. So that's going to be the focus next time.
Mary Kay Magstad is the host and creator of the podcast, Whose Century Is It? You can find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. As always, a pleasure, Mary Kay. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Carol.
Here's some Beatles trivia that might be news to even the most hardcore fans. An English teacher in Spain might be responsible for convincing the band to include lyrics in the liner notes on their albums. That teacher's name was Juan Carrión, and he died this week at the age of 93. He came up with this idea, which was novel at the time, of using Beatles lyrics to teach English.
But he had a problem, of course, because he didn't always understand what was being said.
That's Richard Tornay, a reporter in Spain. Tornay says Carrión wrote down what he heard as best he could in a notebook, leaving blank spots for the words he couldn't decipher. Remember, no Google back in 1966. But then Carrión got an idea. Why not ask John Lennon himself to fill in the blanks?
So when he heard that John Lennon was coming to Spain to make a film, he got it in his head that he was going to seek John Lennon out. He was going to meet him and he was going to find out whether or not he'd be willing to help him out with this.
So this is 1966 in southern Spain. He wants to meet John Lennon, who's hugely popular at this point. How did he end up meeting him?
Well, he got on a bus and drove from Murcia to Almeria. It was about a two-hour bus journey away. He had very little money on him, and he just starts asking around. And to cut a long story short, he managed to meet a man called Les Anthony, who was John Lennon's bodyguard and chauffeur, and they struck up a very quick friendship, and he started passing on these lyric sheets to him to give to John Lennon to correct.
So he takes a bus from his town to Almeria, asks around, finally makes this connection, and just kind of hangs out till he gets to meet him and gets this bodyguard to pass the lyrics to John Lennon.
Yes, it took about a week, and he finally got to meet him. It was a short meeting. It was about, I think, half an hour at the most. But they got on well. And John Lennon made three promises to Juan Carrión as a result of that meeting. One of those was that he would send him the lyrics by post of Beatles songs before they were released on albums, that he would publish that the lyrics would appear on the next Beatles album. In this case, it was Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And finally, that he would visit him in Cartagena in his academy when he could, as we know now that he kept two of those promises.
So he actually ended up sending him the lyrics beforehand?
Yes, and there's that went on for about 2.5 years or so. I understand that they kept some sort of correspondence going. I understand that it fell apart when the Beatles broke up and when John Lennon was with Yoko Ono.
Richard, I know you met Juan Carrión. What was he like?
He was a very interesting man. You've got to understand that this is a person who was born in the 20s. He grew up in Civil War Spain, so he knew what hardship was like, real hardship. He was in his 40s when he met John Lennon. So he was he was brought up in a sort of conservative, he had a conservative Catholic upbringing, and yet he was very much of a free thinker and very much interested in opening new horizons. There's a very interesting photograph of him just a few years ago at a Beatles convention here in Almeria where he's dancing on at a concert. And he's mixing it there with the young people. This is a man in his late 80s, and he's mixing it with people in their 20s and so on. And he dressed in a very, he was quite a snappy dresser. He wore a suit when he came to these events and a very thin tie. And he wore square-rimmed sunglasses. So he was quite remarkable in that way. He was a man of his generation, but very much a forward thinker in many ways.
Do we know what Juan Carrión's students thought of his methods of sort of playing pop songs and Beatles songs?
By all accounts, they all speak highly of him. Mostly his vitality and his enthusiasm and his interest in trying new things, new methods when it comes to teaching English. And at the wake this week, there was a flock of students came to his funeral to see him. There were students from the 60s and 70s who hadn't forgotten him, had understood that he made a big impression on their lives. Many of them went on to become English teachers as well, from what I gather. So he did leave a big imprint in people's lives.
Richard Tournay is a reporter in southern Spain. He's been telling us about the story of a Spanish-English teacher, Juan Carrión, and John Lennon. Thanks a lot, Richard.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Tournay mentioned that John Lennon was working on a movie set in southern Spain. That film was called How I Won the War, and it turned out to be a bit of a flop. But Lennon wrote a little song during his time in Almería. Maybe you've heard of it.
Let me take you back, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. I think it's real. Nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry.
Ah, the joys of the hardworking scientist.
I was actually freaking out and screaming around inside of the lab before this amazing discovery.
That's David Tanasi. He's an archaeologist at the University of South Florida. He told the BBC that his team's amazing discovery came from a terracotta jar found in a cave in Sicily. The jar dates back to the Copper Age, but it was the residue inside that interested Tanasi.
The chemical analysis that we carried out on the residue pointed to the presence of tartaric acid and salt tartrate, which are in the scientific literature the markers of wine.
A 6,000-year-old wine. That's some vintage, says Tanasi.
I did not expect to find any wine in that sample, because the jar in which the residue was found is actually a larger container, which we archaeologists usually assume was used for oil or for cereals. And instead, it turned out to be used for wine. So this discovery has an impact on the way in which archaeologists study the repertoire of shapes in ancient pottery. We assume that certain vessels were used to contain certain kind of food, but it's only chemistry which can tell us exactly what they contained.
Up to now, Tanasi says, the earliest evidence of winemaking went back to around 1000 BC or so.
So yes, this discovery changes a little bit our perspective on the economic activities carried out by the prehistoric communities in Sicily back in those days, because we didn't have viticulture in the equation. Now, the agriculture certainly involved an extensive use of land for the viticulture. So certainly wine was a valuable good, which was at the center of this exchange system.
Tanasi and his team have written up their findings in the Microchemical Journal. I suggest pairing the article with a glass of Italian red. We've got time for one more story today. It's about a... Oh, never mind. Here's the world's Sarah Birnbaum.
So what does a nationalist Israeli song have to do with I Started a Joke by the Bee Gees? Well, I'll get to that. But first, a little background. This first song was written in 1968 by two Israeli composers. Their names are Yair Rosenblum and Yoram Tehar Lev. And it became a huge hit. It's called Ammunition Hill, after the site of a brutal battle in the Six-Day War. The lyrics are, "We went down into the trenches, into the pits and channels, and towards the death in the tunnels of Ammunition Hill." And then, of course, there's this. I Started a Joke, written the same year, 1968, on the other side of the world by the Bee Gees. The story goes that the Bee Gees were on a plane, and the sound from the propellers made them think of this melody. And they were probably high. So yeah, nationalist Israeli battle song, AM radio schmaltz. The songs seem worlds apart.
Actually, what I'm looking for is the right tension.
That's Roy Assaf. He's an Israeli choreographer and dancer, and he loves tension so much that he's bringing these songs together in a dance, of all things. The dance is called The Hill, after Ammunition Hill from the song, and it had its U.S. premiere this summer at Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in Western Massachusetts. And it's pretty unusual. It's a trio for male dancers, Asaf is one of them, and it's about war and its psychological effects.
Lots of people told me that, you know, people might think that you're supporting, war, that you're in favor of wars building heroes, and the honor of being a soldier, and I don't know, whatever.
And you're just like, that's not my agenda?
Exactly.
Asaf himself began dancing professionally while he was still in the army. In Israel, everyone goes into the army for 2 or 3 years when they're 18. Asaf was home for the weekend to perform with a dance group at a local community center when he was spotted by the superstar choreographer Emmanuel Gott and offered a job.
When he tells the story, he says, I just saw you walking and I fell in love in the way you walk.
For the rest of his time in the army, Asaf would serve during the week and go into the studio to dance on the weekends. In the 11 years since then, he's danced all over the world and started a company of his own. And now he's turning to military themes. His dance, The Hill, starts with three soldiers goofing around. And it's funny. At one point, the guys grab each other's butts and sway side to side. But then the boys begin to fight each other. And you're not sure if they're play fighting or real fighting. They begin kicking and pushing and shoving.
And they start to fight until they are exhausted. And the only place that they have is crying. And after crying, they want to die.
That's the dance? That's it? Which started the whole
world living. You know, again, once I described it, it's not accurate. Because there is more to it. So I would now say these three men finish in a very different places. One is standing, one is lying on the floor, and one is walking outside of the stage.
And all the time, this saccharine, poppy, 1968 hallucinogenic song plays in the background. Asaf says he left the dance intentionally open-ended.
It's a symbol. And the person you are, with your own experiences that you had in life, you will choose what you feel about this moment. You can describe for yourself what it is and what every man represents.
Asaf says after one performance, he got an email from the spouse of a veteran. She said she spent years caring for her husband with PTSD, and the dance spoke to her about that pain. Asaf says he didn't set out to do that. But to me, it can't be a coincidence that Asaf started dancing in the army, and now he's understanding that experience through dance. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Beckett, Massachusetts.
That puts a wrap on the show today. Eric Goldberg composed our theme music. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great Labor Day weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.